Okay, folks. So I understand that this is sort of going to be the stable set of faces I'll be seeing for a couple of days more, because the drop ad is over, right? I guess you forgot to drop. okay, so there are a bunch of administrative things. These people, I'm getting bounces for mail sent to their addresses. Unfortunately, I can't tell them on the email that I'm getting bounces, so I have to say in front of all of you that, you know, these people should contact me with alternate addresses. Bunch of people are having still some blog posting issues. If you're still having trouble posting on the blog and you wanted to, there was some discussion on the blog itself about this. You should just look up, where is that? Where did we go? Somewhere on the blog. What happened to this? Somewhere on the blog, there's actually a bunch of sign-in problems. Like, there you go. So, and Lei actually made some comments here, and then there are two comments, and you can look at them to figure out and see if you can, you know, send postings to. So other people have overcome this problem, so it should be possible. Okay. Assignment zero is due next Monday, next Tuesday. Yeah. So that was meant only for refreshing your Lisp skills and to get you to install the Lisp and actually, you know, write some programs, etc., etc. How many of you is there anybody who is having problems installing Lisp? I mean, I sent a mail last week about a free Lisp, which seems to be as good as you can ever get by paying money for at least the 471 use. Okay. So that's, and in fact, writing Lisp programs with Emacs interface is probably the very best thing to do. You know, it's like, it's nice connected interface. So that way you don't actually have to go and use the Allegro Common Lisp on the department machine if you don't want to. Okay, I think as far as I'm concerned, as far as I could tell, there is no restrictions, no heap size restrictions, etc., on this list. So you should be able to get everything done with that. And then homework one, I gave some of the questions. So I gave some of the questions. Basically, these are things that you should be able to do given last class's discussion. And, you know, if you haven't and if you have questions, you could still, there may be some other things that we'll discuss today, which is also relevant. Some people still are having trouble understanding this idea of asynchronous homework. All I meant was that as soon as I have completed a topic, I'll post the homework problems for that. And then when I've decided there are enough problems that I want to grade them, I want to have them graded, then I would say I'm going to close homework one, and then it will be due from then, from 1 week from then. And I'll say that explicitly, so nothing will be done behind your back. So you would have at least 1 week. If you sleep all the way until I tell you you have 1 week, you just have 1 week, you know. But I think you might want to do it as and when they're given, because that way you remember what's being discussed. Okay, and then a related question is, Will Cushing sent a message to the class mailing list, which is also, of course, put on the blog somewhere, but this one. He is willing to have a recitation session. So again, you already have TA hours. You can go to the TA hours and ask all the questions. You can come to my office hours, ask me questions. But sometimes people are so lost that they don't even know where to begin and would like to go sit somewhere else where people are already decided for them what they should know. Or that's one cynical way of looking at it. The other way of looking at it is recitation sessions sometimes allow you to ask questions beyond what has been discussed in the class. And Will is a smart kid. He's taken this course, and he is willing to do a recitation session if people are interested. And he sent a mail as to how you can tell him whether you want to come or not. And he's given some times, and then if you're interested, send him a mail back. Okay? And then he'll let you know where it's going to be held, etc. So this is optional. This is, if you're interested, you can do this. As I said, there were some like 20 people who said they're quite interested. I don't know whether they're still around, but it would be something that you can do. Okay. So just, that's basically the only things I have. So regarding the recitation sessions, I guess Will was asking me as to what would be the format, and we thought rather than have it every week, maybe have it with respect to every homework and see how it goes. And if there's a lot of interest, you can have more. If there's no interest, this will be the last one. And, yes. Yes, you could have that too. Yeah, I mean, in general, he's quite interested in doing it, depending on, how the thing works out. Okay. Any questions on this stuff? Okay. Any questions on anything that we have done last week? Okay. So, what I'm planning to do today is talk about problem-solving agents, and I mentioned that at the end of last class. Just to remind you where we were, we ended with an architecture of an agent called goal-based agent, which has essentially the following pieces. It keeps track of the world state and how the world evolves and what my actions will do to that world. And it has some notion of what its goals are. And based on the sensing information it gets, it actually, and based on how the world evolves, it then reconstructs what the world currently is right now. Notice that this cannot be reconstructed just from the sensory information because sensors could be imperfect and the world could be partially observable. Okay, so if there was a car earlier and you can't see it, it doesn't mean that it has necessarily disappeared. It could be in your blind spot. And the only way you can figure that out is you have to have state information from the previous times, and you have to have realized that cars that were there behind you, which haven't passed you yet, are still around behind you. And so probably they are in the blind spot. So you would have to reconstruct your current state information, both from the sensory data and your model of the world. And having gotten the state information, then you can ask yourself, if this is the state where I am in, what if I do the following action, how would the world be? What would the world look like? So you, the agent, is asking it yourself, okay? And then based on that, so you're thinking about this in your mind, and based on that, you answer the million-dollar question, what action should I do now? And then having figured out the action, you go ahead and do it. Okay, and when you do that action, so when you're thinking about what happens to the world if you do this action, you are not changing the world. The world may still be changing, right? The world may still be changing if it's a dynamic world, okay? But at least you are not changing the world. If it's a static world, when you're thinking, everybody waits. The entire world waits for you to complete your thinking. Okay, if it's a dynamic world, the world is still continuing, but at least you didn't make any change. And this is where you are making changes to the world by doing your action. And then the loop continues. Okay, so this was an architecture that we considered. And with respect to that, we described what are all the various topics that I plan to discuss in the class, how are they justified with respect to this architecture. And we mentioned that to describe your state, your knowledge about the world, and your goals, you need some languages to write that in. And so that's where you talk about knowledge representation languages, and we'll look at least logical and probabilistic representation. And then to actually do this reasoning, what if I do this reasoning? You need to essentially have an ability to consider if I have this state and I do these actions, I'll have these other states, and then if I do those actions in from those states, I'll have more states, and you know, you essentially have to sort of construct this tree of possibilities in your head. Okay, and to do that efficiently, in essence, you would need all these things. These are sometimes competing, sometimes complementary ways of doing that reasoning. The first topic that we'll look at, search, is essentially one way of doing it. Planning, which is very close to search, is another way of doing it. And in general, reasoning about, you know, once you have this knowledge, you actually are reasoning about the knowledge you have to figure out what your current state is. By the way, this block, this is called state estimation. It's called state estimation. So you're estimating your state, and you think, why would you need to estimate your state? I mean, the sensors are telling you. But that was the discussion I just had. You know, sensors only tell you piece of the state. Based on what you have been doing and what you just found out, you get to really estimate which state of the world you are in. Okay, and doing the state estimation also involves reasoning. In fact, these things involve reasoning. Reasoning means not just the language about the, not just the knowledge about the world, but putting that knowledge together to figure out what would be true, what won't be true. Okay, and so that again, that normally the reasoning, another word for it is inference in these languages. Okay, we'll talk about that too, logical inference and Bayesian inference. Okay, so we'll talk about these to understand this part of the picture. We'll talk about the languages to understand this part of the picture. And then I said, learning comes in because if you want your agents to be autonomous, in the sense you not only give it some knowledge, but it figures out the rest of it during its lifetime, then basically each of these pieces can change based on the experience of the agent. And that's where the learning comes in. Okay? So this is just a high-level view of why pieces, the various pieces we'll discuss in this class would be relevant. And again, this is a repetition from last time. And what we're going to do today is one specific way of building an agent like this that we will call a problem-solving agent. Okay, and at some level, what the problem-solving agent does is it packages this stuff and this stuff together. So it does not explicitly write sentences about what is true in the world. As you will see, again, I'll say this and I'll repeat it in a couple of times. The way you figure out what happens if you do a certain action in the world is you call a procedure called the child generation function, which will take a current search node and it'll tell you all the new nodes that can be generated if you do various types of actions. So in some sense, you kind of combine the knowledge about the world as well as the reasoning about the world together. Okay? So it's all in the black box called child generation function. So in a way, you don't need to think about logic, you don't need to think about Bayesian inference, because it's all a C program called child generation function. Okay? And if you have a higher level program which essentially can call this program, you can write a problem-solving agent which can simulate what will happen if it does various things by just repeatedly calling this child generation function and seeing whether it has reached some state of the world where certain goals are true. Now, even whether you reach the goal or not would be another procedure, another black box procedure. Okay? So in the problem-solving agent, there is this, data structure called search node. We'll see again, we'll look at it again in a minute. And it turns out that the agent essentially can't make sense of what is inside the search node. What it can do is it can give this search node to a procedure called child generator, which you write for each problem separately. Okay? And then if this child generator works on the search node, gives a whole bunch of nodes out, saying, if you were to expand this node, you'll get all these other nodes. Okay? And then for each of these nodes, the agent can give these nodes to another function called goal test. Okay? And if it says yes, you're done. If it says no, you're not yet done. So the interesting thing is the agent is sitting in the middle and it has a bunch of sub-procedures that it's using to figure out where to go. Okay, so in a sense, you know, the agent doesn't have to write any knowledge about what's in the search node. All the knowledge is in the child generator and in the goal text. This can be a bug or a feature. It's a feature because you can just doing normal programming. You don't have to talk about knowledge representation. You just write a procedure which generates child generator, which generates children nodes for a specific application. Okay, and another procedure which tests whether the current node is a goal node or not. And all that agent is doing is it's applying a node which it doesn't understand to a procedure which it doesn't understand. And only sees, and then the procedure then, you know, if it's a child generator, it gives a list of nodes, then it goes and puts these nodes back into the possibilities I have to consider. And if it wants to check whether it's done or not, it takes one of these nodes, gives it to another procedure it doesn't understand called goal test. It says yes, you're done. If it says no, then you have to expand that too. Okay? And so even in the case of problem solving agent, it looks as if there's nothing for problem solving agent to do. You know, you write this child generator function, you write this goal test function, you're done. Right? So what else is new as far as AI is concerned, this class is concerned? You know, it's like saying, you know, you should write C++ programs or Java programs for your particular application corresponding to the child generator and the goal test. Okay? But really, what else is there that's general and that you still need to talk about, independent of all the problems? It turns out that the only thing that's left is the search, the way, the order in which you wind up exploring the choices. The order in which you wind up exploring the choices. Up front, it doesn't even look like there's a whole lot to talk about there. But by today's class and tomorrow, I mean the next class, you realize that a whole bunch of interesting issues can be talked about just at the level of, you know, when to, you know, how to explore the various nodes. And how do you do it in such a way that you can get done fast without running out of memory, without taking too long? Okay? That's basically the high level overview of a problem solving agent. So here is a kind of a pseudocode description of a problem-solving agent, and that just says what I told you in that picture. You know, it essentially has this node data structure. It applies a child generator function to the node data structure, gets new nodes, keeps them around, and picks each one of them and tries to re-expand them. But before expanding them, it checks to see if it has reached the goal node. I mean, if it has reached a node, that's already a goal. Okay, now, one point that may still be a question is, whatever is the agent architecture you're looking at, ultimately the question you're trying to answer is, what action should I do now? Okay, how did I answer that question of what action should I do now? The way you have answered it is, the way you have answered it is that it turns out that for each of the nodes that are generated, so the child generator function can take a node n and return nodes n1, n2, etc., nk. And it can say that from n, if you do an operation O1, you get n1, O2, you get n2, etc., ok, you get nk. And there is a pointer for each node to its parent as well as the action that was taken on the parent to get to this node. Now, if you ever reach a goal-bearing state, then you can follow the pointers back all the way to the beginning node and do those actions in the reverse direction. That's it. Okay, so that's ultimately, you know, the reason why search is connected to what must I do now, because you first try to see what you are, there is a goal for this problem, and the search essentially figures out a path from the current state to a state where the goals are satisfied. And when the search is completed, you would know the path from the goal-bearing node to the initial node. And you reverse the path and you do the actions in that way. Now, if the world is static and deterministic, then you can just close your eyes and do those actions one after other and say, I'm done. If the world is not static and it's not deterministic, then all sorts of interesting issues will happen. So, for example, you might do the first of those actions and then check again to see whether you're on the right path. Okay? And if you are not on the right path, you might wind up starting from that state and again trying to go towards a goal-bearing state. So you can call the same search multiple times. Okay. So the idea of what action to do next is essentially, let's see, where is that? Is connected to the, so basically the action is the recommendation of the action for this state, which essentially if you reverse it, it'll tell you what's the, you know, in the initial state, what is the action you're supposed to do, and then what in the next state, what is the action you're supposed to do. So, okay. Here is an example. Let's talk about some examples of actual problems that, you know, so that just you have something concrete to go with. So suppose I have, you know, a problem like this where you are in Romania and you are in a city called Arad and the flight leaves tomorrow from Bucharest and you want to go from Arad to Bucharest. Okay? And so now the question is, if this is what you're trying to solve using your problem solving agent, right? Then you still need to formulate the problem for the problem solving agent. Formulation of the problem involves making the child generator function, making the goal test. Okay, and you know, essentially you the human, so in this particular case, you the human are writing the problem solving agent, which is a program. The human should know what the states are so that the same states are used by the child generator function and the goal test function. But your program doesn't need to know what those states are. All it needs to know is, have I reached the goal, have I not reached the goal? Understand the abstraction. Okay, so we are not completely automated yet. Somebody is going from this natural language problem to writing child generator and goal test functions and starting the search, starting the problem solving agent off. That's you. You're going to do that. Okay. So you will formulate the problem, which involves basically having an idea in your own head about what are the states and what are the operators. And once you have this idea, you can write a child generator function which takes a data structure, part of which is a state, and then gives out a bunch of data structures which correspond to all the other states you can reach by doing these operators over these states. Operators is another word for actions. Okay? So in this case, essentially, so if you have like some notion of the background knowledge of this world, you have it. So in essence, the operators for each state. So if you are here, the operators are go to Cebu, go to Zerind, go to Timisoara. Those are the operations that you can do. And if you are in Cebu, then the operations you can do is go back to Arad, go back to Oradea. In fact, back is not even a reasonable thing to say. Go to Arad, go to Oradea, go to Fragas and Zimbu. So those are the things you can do. Those are the operations. Okay? So now you, the human programmer, would write a child generator function which takes the node and in essence generates new nodes corresponding to all the things you can do. That's all. Okay? And goal test would be different for each problem. Since we want to reach Bucharest, the goal test function for that problem would take a node and check whether the state corresponding to that node is Bucharest. Now here's the interesting thing. The agent is sitting in the middle. This agent which is going to do search is sitting in the middle. And things are passing by its desk. It doesn't understand what's inside the child generator function. It doesn't understand what's inside the goal test function. But it can still get you to the goal as long as the child generator and goal test functions are written correctly by you. You wouldn't like to do search in large spaces. Let the agent, let this program do the search for you. But you get to kind of start it off by this module, in the child generator and goal test. Okay, so in this particular case, it's very clear that really, once you think in terms of states and operators, it corresponds to, in this case, it looks like a map, but really, any problem you have, once you have converted the problem into a set of states and a set of operators which take you from states to states, what you have is a graph like this in abstract level. Okay? And your initial current state would be one of these states. And the state that you want to reach would be one of the other states. Now, notice that the goal state does not have to be a single state. Okay? For example, I might say, I want to reach a state, I mean, reach a, let's say, I want to reach a, which city which has the letter T in its name. That's my goal. Okay, now that basically could be Bucharest, that could be Timisoara, that could be anything else. You know, this I think has a T in it, so this would be one too. So goal test can say yes for more than one state. That's okay. Okay, so for example, if you don't want it this way, suppose this is a map of Lebanon, you may very well have the goal, you know, at least 2 weeks back, get to a place that's far away from the attacks. Any city which doesn't have, you know, things falling on its head, you know, I don't really care about the name of the city. And it may be, you know, maybe hopefully if you are lucky, there'll be more than one such city. Okay, so the name it doesn't matter really in that case. All that matters is the property of that city, which, you know, and which this goal test guy hopefully will understand and will say yes to that. Okay, so now notice actually the other interesting thing. So this is like really a grass search problem, right? So you start from a state and you go to another state. This is what you did in 310. Yes, sir. That's a good question. That's actually a good question. So, if in fact there are multiple goals that have that, you know, so the minimum requirement is problem-solving agent takes you and finds a path which takes you from the current state to a goal state. Now, if you want it to do something optimal, then you can say, take me to the optimal goal state. Optimal goal state. The optimal goal state would essentially, now the question then becomes, how do you define the optimum? You know, one reasonable way to define the optimum is, assume that there are costs on these transitions. Okay? And you assume that the costs are additive. And so in this case, basically, it becomes find the shortest path to a goal node. Shortest path to a goal node, which again is something that you have done. You know, graph search is not at all interesting unless you have to start talking about properties of paths. I mean, just find a path is not as interesting as finding the optimal path. Yes, sir?
Would that be a secondary goal then?
What do you mean?
To find the shortest path or the lowest path?
No, and so the question is, no, the goal test itself tells you whether during the search, goal test will take a node and tell you whether it is a goal-bearing node or not. Okay, to make sure that you reach the optimal such goal, the search has to do that. So the problem solving agent, without knowing what's inside this and what's inside this, and knowing probably just the information such as the cost of the actions, can still get you to the optimal goal node. Okay, so now whether or not that's, I mean, I think that's just part of the specification. Find me the optimal node. And another thing could be that, well, I mean, I'm really looking for a cheap path. Then you might, so again, remember about this optimum issue that I told you earlier. If you want to provide an optimal path, you better make sure when you wrote the algorithm that there's a proof saying that when this guy opens his mouth, he would be optimal, just on arrival. If you have to check after the solution is output whether or not it's optimum, then you're wasting your time because you did everything plus more. Okay, that guy may have just made up a single path and you now have to loop all other paths. Okay? So yes, there are multiple goal nodes. There may be multiple states of the world that correspond to goal nodes, and any one of them is a goal, and you might want to put a quality metric saying I want the shortest path where the path cost is what is actually capturing things like how distant, how far it is. Now, here's the interesting thing. I will just say cost, but then how do you put cost on these things? So think of this as just a roadmap. Okay? What should be the cost on the action? Different people will say different things. Some people say distance. Some people say how scenic the route is. You know, some people say, you know, how costly it is to travel on that road, and you know, some of these roads may be toll roads. Okay, so in general, actually, the costs on this may be multiple different types. So I will assume for now that you somehow converted all of this into a dollar cost, a single unit currency. Okay? And the number that you give as the cost is just combines the scenicness of the road, if you care about that, and the distance that you travel, if you care about that, and the tolls that you pay, if you care about that. Okay? If you do not want to separate them, then the optimization problem becomes slightly harder. It becomes what's called a multi-objective optimization. You have multiple different objectives, and you're trying to optimize with respect to all of them. Okay, this is what we wind up doing all the time in travel, right? When you're trying to find a flight, you know, some people are just looking for the cheapest flight. Some people are looking for the cheapest flight with the least number of stops on my favorite airline, which has, where I have frequent flyer miles and all this stuff. Okay, in such cases, it becomes harder. In fact, the notion of optimum itself is slightly more interesting notion. We won't go into it. You know, at some point of time, I might talk to you about how do you deal with optimality in the context of multiple objectives. For now, let's assume that somebody put them all together and gave you a single number, which is the cost. Okay? Yes?
So you were given this example of Lebanon. Mm-hmm. But the difference is this one is a static world, as in it's not changed. Your goal is there and it's not changing everywhere.
Complete.
That one is dynamic, right?
Yes. No, again, yeah, I think that's a very good point. I mean, to the extent during the time that you're doing the search, the map changes. Okay, and it was changing during the Lebanon War because various roads were getting bombed out, right? Then obviously it's a dynamic world. And so what you thought you could do, you can't do anymore. Okay, but that's again, and what's more interesting is that even after you completed the search, so here are like two times that are involved. Okay, time one is you're sitting, let's say this is some sort of a Lebanese city, you're sitting here and you decided to go to some city where there is no bombing going on, and then you started off your search algorithm, and you know it took like 3 minutes on you know the current working Windows operating system, and told you here are the roads you should take to reach this particular place. So it's possible that during these 3 minutes the world has changed, including you are not sitting anymore, you got blown to bits. Okay. Hopefully, that if that happens, clearly it's dynamic, and it's, you also realize that there's no point in sticking to the current solution. What's more interesting is you have a solution in 3 minutes. Hopefully, in 3 minutes nothing happens. So you start driving slowly, and then you reach some halfway point, and then this remember that what the problem-solving agent would tell you in this case is go from Arad to Cebu, Cebu to let's say Rimbo, and then from there to here, and then from there to here. So as you reach here, you may have realized that all these roads have been destroyed now. So then you redo the search. That's possible. Okay. So since we are talking about that sort of a thing, let's look actually at within the context of this sort of a problem-solving agent, with this child generator node and the goal test node. Child generator function and the goal test function. Let's talk about the various kinds of problems that can be solved. We actually just talked about several of them. Okay, one, the simplest one is I have a single state from where I'm starting. Okay, and the map isn't changing, and nobody else. I mean, it's a static world. It has deterministic actions. Okay, and so basically, you not only complete the problem solving, you just execute the solution. And you would reach the goal. Okay. Starting from there with the version that we talked about in Lebanon seems much farther away. It still is the single state, but map is changing. So child generator function is changing during the problem solving. That's to some extent the opposite extreme. There are in-between. For example, it could be the case, although it doesn't work well in the cities, the traveling kind of scenarios, sometimes you may not know which state of the world you are in. I mean, I think, how drunk are you to not even know which city you are in? Okay, but yeah, city problem, you would know which city you are in. But there are many other problems where your sensors are not good enough. So as far as you're concerned, you could be in one of five different states. In that case, It's called multiple initial state problem. Okay, so the simplest problem we talked about till now was single initial state, multiple goal state. Now somehow multiple goal state is not seen as a problem. If you have multiple goal states, is it a bug or a feature? Feature. You better understand that. If I tell you there are 15,000 ways in which you can get an A plus in this course and today, and then somebody else and says in my course there's only one way you can get an A plus, I'm being more flexible. I'm giving you 15,000 ways. Maybe they're all very hard, but I'm giving you more ways. More goals is good. But more initial states, on the other hand, isn't good. That basically means you have no clue where you are. So first you have to figure out where you are before you know, before you can figure out where you need to go. You understand what I'm saying? So goal and initial states are actually asymmetric. The more number of goal states you have, the better off you are. The fewer initial states you have, the better off you are. And you will wind up having fewer, you know, more initial states if you have bad sensors, if you don't know about your world. The sensors is what tells you which state you are in. Okay? Now, suppose you do have good sensors. Suppose somebody did tell you what your initial state is, and it's a single initial state, but your actions are non-deterministic. That means when you do this action, you can either go to state S1 or state S2. You don't know for sure. Now in the previous example, it was deterministic. If you take this road, you would go from Arad to Timisoara, nowhere else. So for each action, there is a direct output, a deterministic output. Okay? But there are scenarios where an action might actually wind up having multiple possible effects. So for example, I currently have a coin here which is heads. Now I'm going to do a toss on this coin. I don't know which state I'm going to be in. I could be in the head state or in the tail state. Do you understand what I'm saying? So now I started from a single state, but after some actions it became multiple states. And whenever you have multiple states, problem is harder. You have to first figure out which state you are in to actually, you know, get to the goal state. Okay? So let's look at an example, a concrete example, which sort of gives you some feel for this sort of differences. This is this vacuum agent, and you have a vacuum cleaner and two rooms, and there may be dirt in one or both the rooms or none of the rooms. Okay, there may be dirt in the room one, there may be dirt in room two, or there may be no dirt at all anywhere. And the vacuum cleaner could be in the room on the left or room on the right. That's your world. This is the world you are living in. Now, what are the actions you can do if you have a vacuum cleaner? You know, a vacuum cleaner presumably can go left, go right, because this is, you know, there's nothing else that it needs to do here. Go left, go right, and the thing that you are designed to do sucks. Okay, so suck the dirt. Those are the three actions that this agent can do. Okay? Now, if you have that, you can start having, let me see. Here is a graph of states, you know, of the vacuum agent. This is a state graph. So, for example, it tells you if you are in this state and you go left, you will be in the same state. Because you can't go left, okay? And if you are in this state and you go right, you go to this state, and then if you go left, you come to this state again, okay? And then so on and so forth. So if you are in this state and you do a suck action, then you would be in this state. So dirt here is still there, the dirt here is gone. Okay? So this is your, is there any difference having gone from the description to the state graph? Is there any difference between this and the Bucharest traveling? No, because they're both graphs. And presumably you know where your initial state is. If somebody tells you this is your initial state and for whatever reason I always want to reach this state as the goal state because I like to keep my vacuum cleaner on the right hand side room after I'm done. And there should be no dirt left. Okay? That in this case, this is a single initial state, and you know, and any of the, and so if I can reach this state, then I'll reach the goal. Now, for people who don't care about exactly where the vacuum cleaner is, they're not as compulsive. Okay, they say, just keep the apartment clean. Doesn't really matter finally where you leave the vacuum cleaner. For them, this is a goal state, this is a goal state. Who would you rather have as your boss? The guy who doesn't care where the vacuum cleaner is. Because you could either get here or get here and be done. Whereas, if there is a place for the vacuum cleaner, it's costlier because then you have to go to exactly that goal state. There are fewer states where, you know, the goal is satisfied. Now, here is my question. In this scenario, suppose I don't know in the beginning which rooms have dirt. That's a reasonable thing. I mean, you know, in a vacuum cleaner scenario, people shouldn't have to tell you, by the way, there is dirt in room 1, there's no dirt in room 2. You know, you should be able to just figure it out and, you know, still be able to succeed in life if you're a vacuum agent. You know, your life is simple enough and you should at least deal with it. So the question then is, if I don't know which room has dirt, and furthermore, I also don't know where I am, whether the vacuum cleaner is in the right side or the left side, then what is the initial state? What is the initial state? What? No, what is the initial state? If I don't know, remember that initial state could be a set of states. If you don't know which state you are in, initial state could be a set of states. So if I don't know where the vacuum cleaner is and where the dirt is, then the initial state is any one of these 8 states. Complete uncertainty means you're equally likely to be in any state of the world. Okay? So people tend to underestimate what it means not to know anything. Okay? I mean, just because you don't necessarily know exactly where the dirt is and exactly where the vacuum cleaner is doesn't necessarily mean, I mean, so if I just don't know where the dirt is, but I know that the vacuum cleaner is on the left-hand side, then how many states am I in? 4. So you are way better than the loser who doesn't even know where the vacuum cleaner is. Okay? So the more uncertainty means even more number of states that are possible states for you. Complete and utter uncertainty means I could be pretty much in any possible state of my world. And really, really complete and utter uncertainty means I could be potentially in any of the states of my world with exactly uniform probability. Okay, I could also have a scenario where I could be in potentially any of the states of the world except the probability that I am in this state is 0.99999 and the rest of the states cumulatively come to the rest of the probability. Okay, that's much better. That's a PK distribution, so you at least know where you are. Okay, so I'm trying to explain to you that there are degrees of not knowing where you are. The guy who knows that he's one of the 4 different states is better off than the guy who knows that he's in one of the 8 different states. And the guy who knows that he's more likely to be in the middle 2 states in one of the 8 states is better off than the guy who thinks that he could be in any of the 8 states with equal probability. These are different levels of knowledge about your world. Okay? So, in this case, if you don't know the initial state, then what is the search space you are searching in? You are searching in this search space. This is the graph for you if you don't know the initial state. So each node now corresponds to a set of the original state. Okay? And when you do an action, it takes you from one set to another set of states. Do you understand what I'm saying? Okay. Now, so actions could be used to reduce uncertainty as well as to reach the goal. Previously, actions should only be used to reach the goal. You know, go towards the direction where you become closer and closer to the goal. That's what you would do. But in these kinds of scenarios, when you have uncertainty as to where you are, you might do actions to first, sometimes you might do actions Not because they get you closer to the goal, but because they just make you realize where you are. And so, for example, if you are in this state, as soon as you do a left action, you are now in this state, which is only four states. So we need a new terminology. I'm calling these states and the inside ones also states. Let's call the big ones belief states. Belief state. A belief state really is a set of real world states. A belief state is a set of real world states. Now, if you have S number of states, then how many belief states can you potentially have? Remember that a belief state is a subset of states. If you have S number of states, how many belief states can you have? 2 power S. 2 power S. Okay. Now, if your state, in the case of vacuum cleaner, it turns out that the state really had three features. We call them features. I'm sorry. There are three features for the state, which is which room is the vacuum cleaner is in. Right, and whether there is dirt, and which room is the dirt, which room has dirt. Okay, no dirt, left side dirt, right side dirt. And also the, you know, vacuum cleaner being in the left room versus right room. So position of the robot, which is left or right, and presence of dirt in left room, presence of dirt in right room. There are three features. Okay, each of them can be sort of two valued. Two possible values for each of the features. So, if there were three features, you have 2 power 3 states. And if you have 2 power 3 states, you have 2 power 3 belief states. Okay. So now if you think, is really life easier for blind people? This is what blind people deal with. They deal with a much larger world because the states for them are belief states. Because they can't differentiate, you know, in some of the states that you can differentiate, they can't. So for them, they could be, so, you know, I'm in a room which is cold is, let's say, the maximum that I'm telling you. You could be in many, many possible rooms. Okay? So anyway, in general, if there are F features, you have 2 power F states and you have 2 power F belief states. And when you have state uncertainty, you search really in the space of belief states. If you have state uncertainty, you search in the space of belief states. Now, you can have state uncertainty for two different reasons. One is because you didn't know which state you were in to begin with. The other is you did know which state you were in, but you did an action and you no longer can predict after that action which state you would be in. So for example, in the coin scenario, I might start from a coin which is showing sales right now. And then I toss it. Okay? And then I would get to a belief state which can be tails or heads. Right? So the actions introduce uncertainty. Interesting thing is actions can introduce uncertainty, actions can reduce uncertainty. Right? Actions can introduce uncertainty, actions can reduce uncertainty. These are all things that we will again come back to later on, but you know, it's sort of interesting even at this level that you can understand it. And you know, you may or may not have thought about these types of differences that come in the problem hardness, just based on whether you know which state you are in, and whether the actions are deterministic or not. Now, when you have a problem scenario like this, if you have a belief state, if this is your belief state space, you can still do problems in this, right? You can still say, I am in this belief state, and I need to get to this belief state. This belief state is a singleton state. Is it actually possible to do that? Yes, because there is a path from there which comes here. And if you do those actions without checking, just do those actions one after other, you will get here. So in this scenario, it so happened that even though you don't know where you are, you can still reach some place with complete certainty. your goal state is complete certainty. Okay. Sometimes that's not possible. Sometimes, for example, if I change this problem in such a way that my vacuum cleaner has the following problem. So the reason you are actually able to get from here to here without knowing where the dirt is because if you go and suck in a room, whether there was dirt before or not, after there is no dirt. Right? And you know, these are conformant plants, and my other favorite politically charged example of conformant plant is whether there are weapons of mass destruction in Iraq or not. No, before we don't know, but after we definitely know. Okay, so you do an action and you can figure out. So there was actually this is called a conformant plant. So it's like a path, a single path without opening your eyes that you can just do action after action after action and you can get to the goal state. Now, is that always the case? No. You cannot always keep your eyes closed while you're doing your execution. Sometimes you have to open your eyes. Okay? And how does that happen in this scenario? In this scenario, there's nothing that you need to open your eyes for. But if I change the problem a little bit, such that my vacuum cleaner has the following problem. If I make, you know, if I start it, and if there is dirt in the room, then there is no dirt afterwards. Okay? But if there is no dirt in the room, what happens is it tends to leave some dirt. And I don't know, actually there are people who have such vacuum cleaners, you know. So it sort of deposits some, thinking this room is missing some, okay. So you do not want to start the vacuum cleaner unless there is actually dirt in the room. Okay, now you might not like this, you know, this looks like you should be buying a better vacuum cleaner. But I'll give you a more compelling example. There are drugs that I can give you that will save you if you have a particular rare disease and will kill you if you do not have a particular rare disease. And your HMO would have to do a test to figure out whether you have that disease or not, and it's cheap for them to just give the drug. Right? And in that is a scenario where that's why you actually first do testing before you give drugs. Okay? So here, similarly, that's the sort of thing that's happening here. When I change the problem, if there is no dirt on the floor, when I actually suck, I will, you know, introduce dirt. In such scenarios, you must, during problem solving, you must sense. You have to have a little sensor which tells you if in the room that you are in, there is dirt or not. And if there is no dirt, don't start the vacuum cleaner. That's equivalent to saying, if the patient doesn't have the following rare disease, don't give her the following medicine. Because it might kill them if they don't have the disease. Okay? So, with that description, actually, I looked at a variety of problem types. And you can go back and carefully look at this slide. You can have the simplest scenario, deterministic world, fully accessible, in which case you have a single initial state, multiple possible goal states. That's the simplest problem, and that's the one we'll talk about for the rest of today's and next class. Okay. You can also have deterministic and inaccessible problem, where you don't know which state you are in, but when you do an action, it's still deterministic. You know exactly what will happen. In such scenarios, it's multiple initial states, multiple goal state problem, and oftentimes you can still find a solution which is just a line of action. Just do action one after other. You just are looking for this path in a much larger graph. It was a graph previously, if it is a graph of size f number of nodes, now you are looking for a graph of size 2 power s number of nodes. Okay? And then you could have non-deterministic. That means you have actions that have outcomes that either cannot be predicted or depend upon the initial state which cannot be predicted. So their outcome cannot also be predicted. Notice that the actions can become uncertain for two different reasons. Tossing action is a scenario where even if you know whether the coin is heads or tails, after it you don't know. Okay? But there are many other actions where even if you know exactly what it does, its effect depends on what the initial state was. And if you don't know the initial state, you don't know the next state either. So for example, in the medical scenario, this drug, they have done research and they have figured out with probability 1, it will kill you if you don't have this disease D1. and with probability 1, it will save you if you do have this Mrs. D1. So it's a deterministic action. But I don't know the state I am in. So if I did not do a costly test on my patient, the patient may or may not have disease D1. So after this drug, he may or may not be alive. Okay, so you can't predict what happens after if you don't know what is there before. So in some sense, the actions can be fully deterministic, but in essence, their effects cannot be predicted because you don't know the previous state. Okay? And in these kinds of scenarios, it really becomes what's called a contingency problem, where based on the situation, you have to do different kinds of actions. So you have to test. During the execution, you have to test. And based on what the test says, you do action A1 or action A2. So if you have this disease D1, you take drug, you know, A. And if you don't have disease D1, then you take drug B. Okay? Now, up until those two, the solution is just a path. It's a single path of action. By the time you came here, the solution is not a path. It's a graph with test nodes in between. So every once in a while, you do a sensing action. I will tell you, go this direction or go this direction. If you go this direction, you do action A1. If you do this direction, you go action A2. So you're actually computing here. In all those cases, you're computing a path in a graph. Here, you're computing a subgraph of the graph, which is a solution. Okay? And then the worst case scenario happens when unknown state space. In all these cases, I'm assuming that I know what my actions are and what they can do. Even knowing that when I toss a coin, it comes either heads or tails is knowing something about the action. Completely not knowing what happens is to say, when I toss a coin, this room might disappear. I have no clue. I just don't know how the world works. So I have to be able to figure out that possibility. I mean, why would you think that a little kid would know that I am in this wall and, you know, I'm kind of rubbing against it and there's a little switch here and somehow those lights go off or a fan starts working? Why is this connected? For little kids, that's not known. Okay, you guys know that the world is connected. There's a causation that might be flowing from this switch to those lights. And kids are essentially oftentimes in unknown state spaces where they don't really know what happens until they do it. And that's a much harder problem. There you are essentially, until if you don't do anything, you will never learn anything. At the same time, when you do something, you're taking the chance that you might be getting out of the knowledge that you have of the world. And so it'll be good, what you figure out would be good for you because you'll know more about the world, but then it could also be bad for you if, in fact, what you'll know is that you die in those cases. Okay? So that's a much harder problem, unknown state space problem, where you have to also do exploration. Okay? And this is the thing that I was telling you earlier, that if you have a state space of size n, in a single state space problem, you can search for a path in the graph of size n. In the multiple state space problem, you search for a path in a graph of size 2 power n, and in the contingency problem, you search for a subgraph of the graph of size 2 power n. And furthermore, if you have f number of features, then n is equal to 2 power f. If the states are described in terms of f features and f Boolean features, then the n itself is actually 2 power f. Okay? And in general, 2 power f is the enemy. Now, 2 power anything is the enemy for computer science people. That's the way we get into trouble. You know, that's exponential growth. Okay. So that's about, so we talked about problem-solving agents. We talked about the fact that they just require a child generator and a goal test function. And we talked about the fact that even within that simple formulation, you can really talk about qualitatively different kinds of problems, the single state problems, the multi-state problems, the non-deterministic problems, and so on and so forth. Okay. Now, having said all that, now we'll go back to the single state problem, which is basically assume that you're in a single initial state, and the goal test tells you whether you reached the goal state. Okay. And so now, I want to talk about how do you solve these problems. And I said already that the only thing that's left unsolved after somebody already gave you child generator and the goal test function is the order in which you explore the graph. The order in which you explore the graph. And this is not surprising to you guys, right? I mean, you know breadth first search. How many of you have never heard of breadth first search? Everybody heard of breadth first search. And everybody also heard of depth first search. Those two at least you know. Okay, now do you think there's any difference between them in terms of what, you know, if you're searching on state graphs of these types, would you think breadth first search is better or depth first search is better? And are there better ideas than that? That's what we're going to find out. Okay, it turns out, for example, how many of you think that breadth first search will kill you on large graphs? How many of you think actually that there is any difference between breadth first and depth first search in terms that matter to a computer science programming guy? That one might take longer versus shorter time, one might take larger versus smaller space, one might definitely give optimal versus not definitely, may not give optimal solution. These are the things that matter, right? How many of you already think that there are qualitative differences between breadth first and depth first search in these kinds of scenarios? Okay, so those of you, bear with me, the rest of them have to be brought to level where you realize that, in fact, breadth first versus depth first are qualitatively different. Okay, and what we'll try to find essentially is to put it mildly, breadth first, when it ends, will give you optimal solution. But it tends to take exponential amount of space. It tends to take exponential amount of space. Okay, both breadth first and depth first are called blind searches. So remember, I'm thinking that you already understand that you're going to explore a state graph. And so once you have a graph search, you can have a breadth first search or a depth first search. Both are blind. They're just essentially, you know, taking a node and applying the child generator function. And before applying the child generator function to the node, you're also applying the goal test function. If the goal test says you're done, you're done. If not, you apply the child generator function. The only difference between them is which order do they expand the nodes? Which order do they submit them to the child generator? And you know the two data structure difference, the important fundamental difference in the data structure between depth first and breadth first is one uses queue, the other uses stack. So depth first, last in, first out. Breadth first, you expand the nodes in the orders they entered the queue. What is the queue we are talking about? The queue is the queue of nodes that is waiting for expansion. In the beginning, that queue is just the single initial state you have. A queue or a stack. Okay? As soon as you take it out and you expand it, then the differences between queues and stacks come. So in the case of breadth first, you expand that node, put all its children, replace it with all its children in the queue. And the same thing depth first does too at the first level. The next level onwards, what happens is depth first will take a node, expand its children, and put them in the front of the queue. So now those guys will be expanded before the guys who came into the queue earlier will get expanded. That's why it's going depth first. Breadth first goes one after other in the order in which things came into the queue. Okay. Now it turns out that breadth first is guaranteed to end with the optimal solution if you define optimality in the following sense. If you define optimality in terms of the number of actions you're doing, number of operations you're doing to go from the initial state to the goal state. And it's not surprising. If you think of a tree, if you think of the state graph to be a tree, right, breadth first is going level 1, level 2, level 3, level 4, and if there is a goal node in level 4, it would find that before finding any goal node in level 5. Guaranteed. Okay? What about depth first? It doesn't go level by level. So if you think, let's say, that depth first is going, you know, some order. So in the case of depth first, you have to decide, you know, by convention, you assume that you go left first. Okay? So if you have two children, you expand the left child, and then you expand its left child, and you expand its left child, And then if you have no more children here, then you come up and you expand the previous guy's children. Now if you do that, then a leftmost goal in the 15th level may well be found before a 7th level goal, which is on the rightmost side. Do you see this? Pretty darn obvious. So depth first is not guaranteed to find the optimal solution. Breadth first is guaranteed to find the optimal solution. That looks like A, good for breadth first, bad for depth first. It turns out that nobody in their right mind ever uses breadth first. Everybody tends to use depth first. Now, let me ask you one more question. What do you think is the worst case, what do you think is the expected performance of a breadth first versus a depth first search? Do you think one would be much better on the average than the other?
Yes.
On the average?
Log n.
On the average. Ooh, log n? If depth first, see, remember that this is actually an important question. Depth first can sometimes really, really win big time because it goes direct. If you have the goal node in the leftmost side, it just pretty much straight away makes a beeline to that goal node. But the goal node can be pretty much anywhere. So on the average, the goal node could be here or there. When it is there, it will do exponential amount of search. When it is here, it will do linear amount of search. So the question is, what's the average? You can say, well, add this plus this divided by 2, that would be right. It turns out, although it's not often right, in this case, it's actually right. It's actually right. In fact, you can take the worst case and the best case divided by 2. That is the average case. Because for every scenario that is slightly better here, slightly worse here, there is a scenario that's slightly better here, exactly by the same amount. So remember, the leftmost node, instead of the leftmost node, the next to the leftmost node. That's slightly worse for the depth first. And similarly, not the rightmost node, but the next to the rightmost node. That's slightly better. And it's exactly, if you consider the number of expansions of nodes as the metric, which is a reasonable metric, okay, because when you call child generator function, it takes the node and generates all its children. And that's where you spend a lot of time. So if you count, if you measure time in terms of the number of expansions, depth first, essentially the average time for depth first is essentially b power d plus d divided by 2. B power d plus d divided by 2, which is still order of b power d. It's for any tree of branching factor b and depth b. Okay? So this is for trees though. It's not necessarily for graphs. This is for, these are called, what are called the uniform trees. You know, I'm using not any random search graph, but rather a search graph which happens to be a uniform search tree of branching factor b.
Binary
trees. Binary trees have branching factor b equal to 2.
Yeah.
Okay? And you could have b anything. So branching factor b, depth d. And in these trees, at the dth level, you have b power d nodes. Okay? And in these uniform trees, it turns out that there are as many nodes at the last level as there are nodes before the last level. This is true in the binary search trees too. So this is the last level that kills you, irrespective of what the last level is. Okay? Because the interior of the node tree up until level k is about the same size as the number of nodes exactly at the level k. This is true for binary trees. This is true for any branching factor, uniform branching factor. So now here is the interesting. So I told you that if you are lucky and if you really think you win well in card games and Russian roulette sort of things, then you should go with depth first because, at least you have a chance that you might get done fast. Okay, but if you have people like me and the rest of you, and you don't really luck up, it turns out that the average performance for depth first is pretty much the same as the average performance for depth first. And both of them essentially do work of the order of b power d, if b is the branching factor and d is the depth. So So in terms of time, it doesn't make any difference. Both are bad. So what else is left? It looks, if you don't care about time, one gives optimal, the other doesn't give optimal, then it seems like it's an open and shut case. You should go with breadth first because it gives optimal. But nobody does that. Everybody goes with depth first. Not because they think they are the luckiest people on the earth and they can hit the jackpot and get done in D, but because if you look at the size of the queue data structure that they keep in memory, okay, in the case of depth first, okay, in the case of depth first, what happens is you, in essence, your size of your tree would be order of b times b. So here is your node. It has b branching, and then another b branching, another b branching, another b branching, another b branching. B equal to 3 here. Okay. Now, if it turns out that I'm finding a solution somewhere here, right? Then how many nodes am I keeping? How many nodes have I produced and kept on the stack by now? There are d minus 1 nodes here, left for expansion, d minus 1 here, d minus 1 here, d minus 1 here, d minus 1 here. I'm sorry, not d, it's b minus 1. And how many layers are there? D. So B minus 1 times D are order of B times D. That's the space you take. It turns out that that's not the space just for the best case. That's the space you will ever maximally take. That's the maximum space you can ever take. You can take much less than this, but the maximum you take is B times D. What about the breadth-first guy? What's the maximum you take? Now, here's another question. If somebody is asking you about space requirements of a program, what makes sense? The minimal space requirements of a program, the maximum space requirements of a program, or the average space requirement of a program? Which number makes sense? Max. Max. That's it. If your program requires, you know, all your memory plus 1 byte, exactly on the leap year at 12:49.7779 p.m. and you don't have that memory, you die that day. It doesn't say he's been so nice for me all along, you know, I wouldn't need this extra byte from him. If you need the maximum memory, you don't have it, you die. So space, you care about the maximum space required. Time, you care about the average time. Space, you care about the maximum space. Okay? Now, what is the maximum space for depth first? B times D. What is the maximum space for breadth first in the same sort of a scenario? It's B power D. B power D. And when does that happen? It actually happens pretty much exactly in the same case. So you expanded until the D-th level node, and you're about to expand this, and then you found it's a goal node. So all of these guys are waiting. And all which guys? Only these guys are waiting. Everybody else on top of it got done. But all its siblings are waiting. And its siblings are B power D. Minus 1, if you care about that minus 1. But you're dead anyway. Okay? So nobody in their right mind likes breadth first search, because it is optimal, but you take too much space. Now, if you want to understand what is too much space that we are talking about, let me give you some numbers. Okay. If you have depth 14 and you have a branching factor of 10, you would need 11 terabytes of memory in the worst case. 11 terabytes of memory in the worst case. You know, so you'll say, you know, I'll start using secondary disk space, but still I don't see too many people with terabytes of memory even in their disk. This is bad. Okay? So then the question is this. We have two blind search algorithms that all of you understand. One is called breadth first, one is called depth first. Both of them have problems. They are equal in terms of the time. One guy gives optimality but takes linear space, but takes exponential space. Another guy takes linear space but has no optimality. What is more interesting about the depth first is, will it terminate? You know, forget about finding the optimal goal. What if you don't terminate? What if the program goes into a loop? Turns out that depth first can go into loops on graphs. So you go from Arad to Cebu, Cebu back to Arad, back to Cebu, back to Arad, back to Cebu. And you might say, you can stop that, just remember where you have been. And if you are again going back there, don't go back there. If you want to remember where you have been, how many states do you have to remember in the worst case? B power D. So it doesn't matter which hammer you hit yourself head with. You have a Q which is B times D, but then there is this other thing called the places I have been to, which is B power D. So there is no way you can make depth first search not go into loop without killing its essential property of linear space. Do you understand what I'm saying? So depth first search does not terminate. It takes linear space but does not even terminate, and definitely doesn't give optimal solution. It might sometimes by mistake give optimal solutions, but when I say optimal, you better have a proof saying whenever you open your mouth and give me a solution, it is optimal. I don't have to check anybody. It has to be by definition, it is optimal. And we know that it's not. The real question is, can we write a blind search algorithm that takes linear space, gives optimal solutions, doesn't take much more time than breadth first and depth first? This is the first piece of interesting information you are learning in this class. It's too late to learn today. You learn it next class. But essentially what you do is the following. You act as if the tree, if you have a tree of size D, depth D, okay? So you'll first act as if the tree is just this much. So depth D equal to 1. So act as if everybody at this level, they have no children. So child generator node is told to say no children for these guys. Or at least even if it comes back as children, just ignore them. And this subtree, you do what search? Depth first. The reason you're doing this is you want to have linear space. Okay? So on this subtree, you do depth first search. If you found a solution, you output that solution. If not, you now search this part of the tree. Again, using depth first. If you found a solution, you have output that. Now, if you found a solution here, then I can say it's optimal because the only reason you would have come here is because you didn't find a solution here. That means there is no solution of level 1, there is a solution at level 2, so you found the optimal. This is called iterative deepening depth first search. So you are iteratively looking at this tree like this first, then like this. And every time you increase the thing, you are looking at some node that you have looked at previously. Do you understand what I'm saying? So when you are looking at this part of the tree, you are looking at these again. Looks like a huge amount of wasted effort. But what did I tell you about uniform trees? If you think that your trees are, if your search graph is sort of close to uniform tree, what did I tell you about uniform trees? The number of nodes at the last level dominate. Because there are as many nodes at the last level as there are in all the previous levels. So you're not doing much more, really. And in fact, we will, or I'll make you compute the actual number of nodes that depth first, that iterative deepening depth first search would expand. And we can show that it's basically like B plus 1 by B, where B is the branching factor. Now, big deal. It's a little extra, especially for large branching factors. Okay, it does do more work, but hey, if you use breadth first, you would run out of memory. More people can wait for days and days and days together than to reboot the machine at odd hours of the day because you ran out of space. Okay, and if you have patience, and you don't have terabytes of memory, then you can do this guy. This guy does optimality. It doesn't do much worse than the breadth first search. It does have all the beautiful properties of the depth first search, which is taking only b times d amount of space. Okay, this is the first non-trivial specific idea you learned in this class. We'll come back, talk more about this, and go in this way, looking for other kinds of blind search algorithms as well as other kinds of search algorithms which take some piece of information about the problem to improve the search much better. Okay, that's it.